You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you, and I want to thank Leah for helping to organize this, and I also need to thank the Berkman Center in general. This book was written at the Berkman Center many years ago. I tried to figure out how to insinuate my way into it, and I called Eric Saltzman, who was then the director of the center, who happily offered my name to become a fellow, and John Palfrey, who took over, accepted me. So it has been wonderful for me to be at Berkman. And in the back of the book, there's a long list of names to of people who helped me do this. Now I'm called a faculty associate, which sounds even more important, but it just means I'm a faculty member elsewhere. I teach at Kenyon College. So I want to tell you a bit about where this book came from and some things about it that are in it. And I'll talk for about 20 minutes, and then Robert Darden will speak a little bit, and then we'll have some Q&A. One thing that prompted this book, I teach at Kenyon College, and many years ago, the man who directs the library came to me with a letter that he'd received, signed by all the people in the entertainment industry, recording industry, and the movie industry, and so forth. And the letter asked the college, as it asked all colleges, to educate our students about the illegal aspects of file sharing and downloading music and so forth. And it had an argument in this regard, and it ended with the line, "After all, theft is theft." And I remember reading this letter and thinking, well, of course, that's true. Theft is theft. But something bothered me about the presumption of it. And in a funny way, the way this book is set up is an attempt to find other narrative frameworks within which to think about how we circulate the fruits of human imagination. And what I did to make the book was to go back to the founding generation in this country and asking the question, what were those people thinking about when they thought about what we now call intellectual property? That was not a term they used, but so there's a bit of an excavation in search of other ways of thinking about how we relate to these things. When I taught here, I remember Helen Vendler once saying that in terms of the problem of the audience of a book, for whom are you writing? And Helen said that she wrote her books for the person she was before she started writing, which I thought was a nice way of, you know, things you didn't know before you started writing are the things that you try to explain to others and to yourself. So what I'm going to give you is a little sketch of things that are in this book that I did not know when I began to write it. The way it's set up is it begins with a chapter which is a kind of exploration of this theft narrative in which we imagine that we can turn ideas and art into property, and therefore, if you take it without permission, you're a thief. In this line, this is a very old argument. It's been going on for a long time. And in the 18th century in England, one place you see it being argued is between publishers in Scotland and publishers in London, because the Scottish were happily printing books that the publishers in London thought that they owned. And in these arguments, I found one, my favorite citation from the 18th century. So there's one aggrieved Scottish publisher, and he's trying to explain that if a writer were to keep his lucubrations to himself, then perhaps he may be said to have a property in his noddle. But once he prints these lucubrations, and once someone else pays for the book and reads it, the person who buys has the same property as the author had. So the noddle is your head. He may be said to have a property in his noddle if he keeps his lucubrations to himself. I like this probably because I did not know the word lucubrations, which turns out to mean, well, there's a verb, to lucubrate, which is to study by artificial light. So your lucubrations are the fruits of your midnight musings. And what's behind this, of course, is one old idea of property is that it's something from which you can exclude other people. So my house is my own. I think of it as my property, partly because you have to ask my permission to come into it, I can exclude you. So the right to exclude Justice Scalia tells us, is the hallmark of a property right. And what this man is saying is once you have ideas at large in the world, it's hard to exclude others from them, so they cannot possibly be property. And this was a long argument, whether you could even call such things as literature property. Before the 18th century, here's one other citation I'm fond of. This is from Piers Plowman, William Langland's medieval allegory. There's a moment when truth is speaking. She says, "Human intelligence is like water, air, and fire. It cannot be bought and sold. These four things the Father in heaven made to be shared on earth in common." So this is a very old conceit that incorporeal creations of the human imagination are common by nature. And, of course, Jefferson picks this up, as you probably know. "The field of knowledge is the common property of mankind." So what the book does then is to spend a little time trying to think about what a commons is. And I'll tell you two things. We can talk more if you have questions, but two things that stick out for me in my own thinking about this. One is, famously, there's an essay by Garrett Hardin about the tragedy of the commons, which makes the claim that commons naturally collapse. Every rational herdsman will stick a new cow on the field, and soon the fields will be overgrazed and destroyed. And as many people have pointed out, Hardin's essay, smart as it is ahistorical, that the commons, in fact, the agricultural commons in Europe, were highly managed locally. And the word I'm fond of is that they were stinted. That is to say, there were rules that put limits on use such that the commons did not collapse. And so a true commons is a stinted thing, is a thing that has some rules of usage built around the ends towards which it is dedicated. So at some point you have to say, what is the end we're trying to accomplish in having some common asset? And then what should be the ground rules that govern it? So an example of a stinted commons in England, if you were a 17th century English common farmer, you might have the right to cut rushes on the common, but only between Christmas and the 2nd of February. So tomorrow's the last day you can cut rushes. The second thing that I'm fond of in my rehearsal of the commons is it was always the case that common land was surveyed by the villagers annually. So there was a ritual called beating the bounds in which you walked around the commons, and if there had been any encroachments or people putting up fences or hedges where there shouldn't be, you would tear them down. And these were convivial affairs. People would get beer and cakes, and the local constable would go with them, and you would walk around and have a party and tear down anything that encroached upon the commons. So I think beating the bounds and maintaining the commons in this way is it's an ancient right. It's recognized in British law. We should think of it ourselves. An example would be a university which refuses to let the entertainment industry filter its computer traffic would be a university that has a sense of where the boundaries are of its knowledge commons and who should and should not be allowed to enter into them. So then I am not alone in this, but many people have been talking about a kind of what's called a second enclosure. So the first enclosure, this is language that comes out of Europe in the 18th, 19th centuries, of fencing off common land. And particularly Jamie Boyle at Duke has talked about a second enclosure, the enclosure of the commons of the mind, ways in which we are taking things that we thought were our common property and figuring out ways to make them private. And there's a whole chapter on this. The one thing I thought I'd say, because it feeds into something that Bob is going to say, the earliest copyright law is 1710, and it's called the Statute of Anne. It comes out of England. And oddly, one way you could think of it as an enclosure of the commons, that is to say, if before this any published book was anybody's to use, if you suddenly give a property right to authors or publishers, it seems to enclose the commons, which is true. But in an odd way, it also engenders the commons. And so, just to say this briefly, the Statute of Anne gave authors up to 28 years of ownership, and mostly publishers. But what had preceded this was the Crown granting special privileges to printers in London called the Stationers Company, who then had perpetual rights over certain printed works. So you might have the Thompsons, the Seasons, and you were the printer who could always publish this, and nobody else was allowed to. So in a certain way, what the Statute of Anne does is to replace a perpetual monopoly with a short-term monopoly. And in that sense, the fact that it ends after 28 years means that works go into the public domain in a formal way. And it's the first time in history that it's sort of announced that this is the end of ownership, even though there is ownership. Secondly, you had to register to get this privilege. And many people don't care to own their work. They're not in that business. So many, many works enter the public domain immediately. And also, you know, there's a lot of work done on, you know, finally having a limited market in printed works meant that you began to have independent authors and publishers and so forth. And so the beginning of a public sphere independent of the crown and of the church. I want to say one other thing, though, about Statute of Anne. This is a little noted detail, but if you were a printer, if you were an author or printer who claimed the copyright, one of your obligations was to donate 9 copies of each book printed upon the best paper and deliver them for the use of the Royal Library, the libraries of the universities of Oxford and Cambridge, and 6 other collegiate libraries. So along with registering and claiming the right, you had to deposit 9 copies of whatever you claimed. And it makes it clear that this is an act for the encouragement of learning. It is not about creating property rights for individuals. It is a policy decision about how we are going to husband the knowledge that our community creates. And so in this simple business of distributing 9 free copies to the university libraries in England, you see that this is part of what's going on. I say this because it's been the case for years in this country that when you registered a copyright, you had to send 2 copies to the Library of Congress. So the Library of Congress has 2 copies of all the copyrighted books in this nation. And these should be thought of as part of our cultural patrimony, that we own these. And it's been the case for until the present moment that, of course, you had to go to the Library of Congress. It's not a lending library. You can't take them out, but you could go sit there and read them. So in a funny way, there's this current echo of the Statute of Anne in the question of how should we think of the ownership of these books that have been deposited as part of the policy rules we make up around owning knowledge. So I'll just say a bit about the rest of the book. The project, again, was to go back to the founding generation and to think about alternative frames for discussing the ownership of created imaginative works. And the first thing, and I ended up with 3. The first one is that the founders were concerned primarily with creating a democratic, self-governing nation. This was the thing that was on their minds. And to that end, they believed that the barriers to the circulation of knowledge should be very low. And we now think, and the entertainment industry would like our grade school children to think, that what you get when you get a copyright is a property right. But Jefferson and others understood it to be a monopoly privilege, that you were given a short-term monopoly, and it was a privilege granted by the state. It was not a natural right that somehow you got for having made your work. And not only that, but they were very skeptical of monopoly privileges because their experience had been in England that this was one of granting monopoly privileges was one of the ways that the crown controlled commerce and controlled its public. And so you give special rights to somebody to make or import glass, and that person is now your, you are the patron, and there's an indebted relationship and so forth. So there'd been long fights in England between the Parliament and the crown over monopoly privileges. The Parliament saying, you know, if we're going to give any of these, it's the Parliament's duty and not the crown's, and these are dangerous. So Jefferson actually, when they're debating the Constitution, Jefferson actually writes to Jefferson is Paris, and Madison and he are writing back and forth, and Jefferson writes and says, I feel that we ought to have a Bill of Rights that's missing so far, and one of the things in the Bill of Rights has to be a complete prohibition on monopolies. And what Jefferson means is copyright and patent. He sees them as impediments to the free circulation of knowledge, and he thinks they should be outlawed entirely. Now, he changes his mind as time goes on, but that is the sort of outer limit of their own thinking about this. And again, the frame in which it matters to them is democratic self-governance. So the second sort of realm in which you find the founders thinking about the ownership of knowledge has to do with creative communities. And I end up working a lot with Benjamin Franklin on this. Franklin, as you know, retires from the printing business when he's about 42, and he begins to experiment with electricity, and he sends letters about his experiments to friends in England. They get translated into French. And again, for Franklin, it's clear that if you want to have a lively scientific community in which people can talk to one another about what they're doing, you need very low barriers to the circulation of knowledge. So Franklin never takes a copyright, never patents his work, and is very explicit about not doing this and why he doesn't do it. And when he writes his letters to friends in England, he says, please, you are at liberty to communicate this to whomever you please. I'll give you one example of Franklin at work. You know, he's famous for having invented a wood stove. So if you read the pamphlet that Franklin wrote about the wood stove he invented, what you see is that he is drawing on 6 different books that he read in French and in English out from the continent about the circulation of hot air, about fluids, about wood stoves. And, you know, he's making his own wood stove out of a community of people who know about wood stoves, including the local. When I was a kid, we thought the Franklin stove, the invention was to put it out in the room, but that had already, the German immigrants were already doing that. Franklin knew this. So what Franklin's genius here is that he has the mind of a host, that he is somebody who is able to invite into his own intelligence a world of other discussants who are thinking about the same thing he's doing and then make something new out of it. It's not that he isn't an inventor, he is, but the invention is in a context. And this leads actually to the third framing issue that I end up talking about, which is an emphasis on collective being or public being or the common self. I mean, so if you say that somebody like Franklin has the genius of a host, what you're saying is that he's somebody who imagines himself in a community of thinkers. And, you know, he was a famous great reader. But as soon as you are that, what you were doing is you have a library in your head. You are the person who is made up of these other things. There's a footnote in this book because I couldn't figure out how to put it more grandly, but I came across the fact that the word individual has an older antecedent, which is the word dividual, which I did not know before. A dividual person is somebody who conceives of himself or herself in terms of all the things that make him or her up. That is to say, I am not an individual, I'm a person who's constituted by my family, my schooling, my religion. All these things are things that make up me up, and if you were to take them away, I would not exist. So in this sort of collective being that that Franklin represents, you have a individual self, not an individual self. I'll give you 2 other quotes, and then I'll tell you how the book ends. One of my favorite quotations is from Goethe in the 1830s, and somebody's asking him about his own work. And Goethe says, everything that I have seen, heard, and observed, I have collected and exploited. My works have been nourished by countless different individuals, by innocent and wise ones, people of intelligence and dunces. Childhood, maturity, and old age have all brought me their thoughts. I have often reaped what others have sown. My work is the work of a collective being that bears the name of Goethe. A collective being that bears the name of Goethe. So I run with that a bit, and I talk about a number of other people or situations in which, I mean, for the founders, it was about public being in the sense of how do you become a civic actor through whose actions you could acquire civic virtue. You could do the kind of thing that, and civic virtue is a thing which is bestowed upon you by your community. You can't just claim it yourself. You have to actually act and then wait for the community to respond. And so there's a sense there of you are not alone in this. So both intellectually and politically, this collective being mattered. And then I also think it matters artistically and inventively. And among the people I talk about in the book is Bob Dylan, who in the early 60s, if you look at how Dylan was working, it's there's a lot of interesting things about his own sources. But my favorite line in this is he talks about the first time he ever heard Woody Guthrie recordings and how meaningful they were. And he says, I felt listening to, he says, he's like 19 years old. He's listening to Guthrie records. He says, I felt more like myself than ever before. And this is a wonderfully confusing line for me, because what is the self that you recognize in the presence of somebody else's art? That somebody who came before you has created this work that when you hear it, you become yourself. Clearly, it's not an individualist self. It's a self that is awakened in a community or a tradition or a lineage or something. And you don't get it without these people who come before you. So that's the way the book is set up in terms of these other ways of imagining ownership and the ends to which you might think of it. If you want to engender creative communities, if you want to have self-governing nations, if you want to empower people to become civic actors and public beings, then how do you organize your property? You know, the assumption being that we enable or disable certain ways of being through these property rules. So just to end on... I make a distinction between a cultural commons and the public domain, and it's a bit of a definitional thing that just helps me lay something out. But the one problem in this country for a long time has been that the public domain, which consists of all these things that nobody owns, so we can all use them. So Mark Twain's novels are in the public domain. The problem has been that it's been vulnerable to capture. So you get the entertainment industry getting Congress to do retroactive extensions of copyright. And what was about to go into the public domain is taken away. So how do you protect a public domain? How do you make it a stinted commons? How do you have... Well, first of all, you have to realize that you have it and that it matters. And then what the last chapter does is lay out certain certain ways of thinking about this. And so you can do it by law. You can make rules of the road that would protect the commons. And you can also do it normatively. You can get communities together, or nations perhaps, and say this is what we believe and this is how we're going to try to behave. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples. So people who work on the human genome and the other genomic projects met once in the 1990s in Bermuda and talked about the puzzle of sharing or not sharing the data that they were producing. And they came up with a thing called Bermuda Principles, which is a set of rules that the community was then supposed to sign on to. One simple one is the following. In any research facility, once you had described a piece of the genome up to a certain size, you have to release it to the public within 24 hours. And so you put it up on the internet the day that you get to this trigger level. And then there are computer systems internationally which compile this data. And basically every morning, around the world, any research facility is working with the same data set because they have this rule of thumb about sharing the work. And it's not in the law, it's a norm. A second example, a typical example simply would be like this move toward open source publishing that's going on here at Harvard, for example, where the community of scholars agrees that what they write will be put up for free on the internet. As soon as you write it, you can opt out of this, but the default situation is open access of scholarly publications. Again, it's a normative move. And finally, maybe we could have a digital national digital library. you know, we now have this astounding... You know, one reason this topic comes up is because digital copying and the internet have thrown the old rules of the road into great turmoil. And so we're all trying to figure out how to rejigger these rules to some ends that we care about. And digital copying and the availability of books in the digital world is an astounding advance. There's one quotation. I was looking up what Garrett Hardin had used as his sources, and one of them is a 1840s book on population from a guy in England. The only copy around is in the Bodleian Library. Well, within minutes, I had it up on my desk in my little office because it's been digitized. So this is a great move. The question is, how are we going to handle that? So that's a bit about my book. Can you tell us?
I pick it up from here.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book. I really do, Lewis. And I hope you've all read it, but if you haven't, you should. And there are several copies over there. I admire it in many ways. It's beautifully written. It's a terrific read. I think it works well as history. I mean, I think intellectually it's challenging. It's got a great architecture. The way it's put together, I think, works very, very well. And it has a kind of moral, which is what Lewis got to in the last few seconds of his presentation. I would like to seize on the moral and to try to apply it to the situation we are all in now. One way to look at it, though, would be to tell a parable, which I would call Joe Califano as a chicken farmer. Have you all read Free Culture by Larry Lessig? I don't know how familiar you are with it. But, well, he begins the book with a story about some chicken farmers in, I think it's South Carolina, who were doing very well raising chickens, except that this is 1948, the U.S. Air Force had a landing strip nearby and flew right over the chicken house, and the chickens panicked and would take to sort of flight and bash themselves to death against the wall of the chicken house, and so they were suffering damages, and they sued the U.S. government for that because they said, this land belongs to us. And their lawyers cited all kinds of people going back to Blackstone, which indicated that if you own land, you own it all the way down to the center of the earth and all the way up as far as you can possibly go. So the U.S. Air Force was trespassing on this form of property. It went right up to the Supreme Court, and finally Justice Douglas threw it out, saying this violates common sense. It was a wonderful statement that didn't really use a lot of logic. It just threw out the whole argument as untenable in the world of modern technology. That's the world we are now living in, where we've got property laws, copyright laws, that are inadequate to the tasks that need to be done. Now, how does Joe Califano fit into this? Well, he made a famous statement in these debates about the new copyright law, especially the copyright extension law of 1998, in which he argued basically for Disney and Hollywood and so on, to get a copyright law that would go way beyond what the founders wanted, which was 14 years renewable once. In my own view, that was pretty good. It's all been downhill since then. I think that's what it ought to be. And many of you are writers. Wouldn't you be happy if you had copyrights for, you know, 28 years? You could collect royalties on the first 6 weeks, which is when most books earn anything, if they earn anything at all. And then after that, well, let it go out among the people. You know, let the word be spread. Well, Califano obviously was totally opposed to this. And so when he was asked how long should copyright last, he said, forever minus one day. So in that sense, you know, he's not arguing for perpetual copyright, but he wants Hollywood to have its claws into intellectual property indefinitely. And so he was behaving like the chicken farmers. And I think that that position, which is the law in this country, is a position that ought to be rejected and that we ought to get organized in order to try to do something about it. Well, I won't go back over the book because Lewis has done a good job in summarizing it, but there are two aspects of it that I would like to appropriate for an argument toward policy change. The first aspect is the way he uses the founding fathers. I mean, anyone can quote from Jefferson, including the devil, but the selective quoting is not actually the way you make your argument, although you do quote selectively with wonderful skill, I think, Lewis. What you do is to reconstruct a frame of thinking, a way of looking at the world that was Jefferson's and even Madison's, although less so, certainly Benjamin Franklin's, and was a way of looking at the world that became embedded in our founding documents, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, and many other things. So I think this ability to appropriate the founding fathers for a discourse in which we have specific objectives is a very good move and ought to be supported. It's not, I think, tendentious. I think it's, as I said, good history. But it is history in this case with implications. The second aspect has to do with technology and creativity. A lot of people are making this argument about creativity as, well, the extreme form of it in a book by Marcus Boone is plagiarism or copying, as he calls it. He sees creativity as collage, as taking things from lots of different sources, putting them together, adding a sauce that might be your own or prose or whatever it might be, but it's a sort of paste and mix or cut scissors and paste procedure. And if you look back over the history of creativity, there's a lot of that going on all the time, including Goethe and Bob Dylan and others that Lewis mentions. So I think we could take these two notions of creativity as not the romantic notion of genius on the one hand, and on the second hand, a kind of civic value system derived from the founders in order to argue for certain policies. I have one policy in mind, and in fact, the two policies I've tried to promote as director of the Harvard University have been, one, open access. So we had this debate in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, and now in all of the other schools of Harvard, except the medical school, which is almost there, and in any case is adhering to directives from the National Institutes of Health about sharing knowledge. The Faculty of Arts and Sciences, as most of you know, voted unanimously that every professor at Harvard who published and who wrote an article for a scholarly journal ought to deposit that article in a repository, which we've set up. It's called Dash, and it should be made available free of charge to the world. There's an opt-out clause, so we're not violating the freedom of authors, but I think the point is to do exactly what Jefferson wanted done, namely to share knowledge and not to fence it off by a kind of enclosure movement. The second policy has to do with openness in general. We have an open collections program in which we digitize works scattered throughout the university's 73 libraries, works that are concerned a particular theme, such as women at work, migration, immigration, voyages of scientific discovery, and so on. And it's a very expensive and elaborate program, but we have brought together these works, put them also in a digital repository, and they are now consulted widely around the world. So the idea is to share our intellectual wealth and not to look upon Harvard as a kind of privileged bastion of knowledge reserved for the privileged students and faculty who inhabit it. The ultimate extension of this will be, indeed, a national digital library, I hope, or the phrase we now prefer is a digital public library of America. The basic idea is to create a coalition of research libraries whose holdings would be digitized and coordinated through a distributed system. So you would have databases all over. They would be mutually compatible so that any reader anywhere in the world could have access to this vast stock of inherited intellectual wealth. There would be, secondly, a coalition of foundations who would provide the financial support. I think, actually, that that's possible. It sounds utopian, but we've already taken steps toward in this direction, and it looks as though we can do it. But, I'm simplifying, there are lots of other things that need doing, especially legislation concerning orphan books and so on. So it's a moment when I think the message of Lewis Hyde's book is really relevant to something that is urgent today. And I think if we don't do it now, that the domain of knowledge will be commercialized and exploited by companies who have the technology, the finance, and even the legislative or judicial protection in order to exploit this domain. So we are, I think, at a moment when the knowledge commons is in danger of a sort of, if you like, enclosure movement that would subject it to commercialization rather than democratization. Well, that's a mouthful, and probably there are lots of things you want to discuss. Just to toss out, though, some, in case we sound as though we're agreeing too easily, there are other aspects of the story that I think need investigation and that are disruptive of this agreement. One thing was clear that in the agitation around, first of all, the abolition of censorship, pre-publication censorship in 1695, and then the Statute of Anne in 1710, was a concern for monopolies. There wasn't much talk about the rights of the authors. In fact, the authors are only named in the title to the Statute of Anne. The text of the statute doesn't talk about authors much at all, because it was assumed that insofar as there are property rights, they would be held by the members of the Stationers' Company. Now, that company was detested by many members of Parliament throughout these debates because of its monopoly. And so a lot of the motivation, I think, was not to redefine the concept of intellectual property in a viable manner, but rather to break the monopolistic stranglehold of the Stationers' Company. And indeed, their reaction to the 1710 law is very interesting. They had various devices, such as the conjure system and something known as the English stock, to really control the output of books. It was only when the competition got serious, mainly from Scotland, but also from Ireland, that they began to mobilize, and there were a whole series of court suits that run through the 18th century in which they argued for perpetual copyright. Now, on their side were some of the good guys. I mean, we cite Jefferson, especially Franklin, as people that we would like to invoke in developing arguments, but what do you do with Blackstone or Pope or even Defoe? Or if you cross the channel, what do you do with, I hate to say it, Diderot? Diderot's arguments go for perpetual copyright. And in fact, you could argue that Milton's did, even though Milton wasn't part of this debate because he came earlier. But Areopagitica has great passages which seem to indicate that out of the soul of the author as creator comes this product, the written text, which is his property. It's the best part of him, and it should be eternally his. Milton doesn't actually go that far, but there is the counter-argument, and it coincides with the development of the cult of the author in the late 18th and especially the 19th century, what the French call the sacre de l'écrivain. The notion of the author as a creative genius and his or her work being really something that is so particularly the creation of that individual that there should be a perpetual copyright to it. So I think we have to shed that notion of the romantic author, but we're still stuck with it. I don't know how many of you have that feeling when you read great works of literature, but often the romantic presuppositions, I think, are still with us. So I see that as something to be combated. And the whole history of authorship, which is something that has been well studied, but there's a lot more to be done on it, I think would involve that sort of notion, the creation of a norm and its now disintegration with new versions of what authorship is, in which you could wheel in Walter Benjamin and Roland Barthes and lots of other people. Well, I don't mean to go on and on, but my point is that we could, I think, take the argument of this book and apply it to a campaign to create a digital public library of America. I think that we need to write to our congressmen and women in order to get support for changing legislation, first of all concerning orphan books, but then concerning copyright in general. And I think we need also to mobilize authors, because many of you are authors or will be authors, in order to develop a system in which books that are out of print but in copyright can be made available to readers in general. So there's a lot to be done, but I want to thank Lewis Hyde for making out a strong case for doing it.
I should say that the one character in the founding generation who I talk about in terms of perpetual natural right is Noah Webster. And so Noah Webster comes in as a kind of counterpoint to these other guys, because that side of the argument is never absent, and you can find it early in our country too. But let's see if there's questions or answers.
Right. Well, I've somehow been cast in the role of an adversary of Google. And I should say I admire the Googlers in many ways. They're amazing people. I mean, they're not to mention their technological skills and their ability to make money, but their sheer chutzpah. I mean, the energy at Mountain View is something remarkable. So there's something inspiring about Google, but there is also something, as I see it, dangerous about Google, because they are so successful that they could indeed take over what we think of as the public domain. How would they do it? Well, partly because of their superiority in technology and finance, but also because of the famous Google Book Search agreement between them and the publishers and authors who sued them for breach of copyright. Now, if you read that settlement, as it's called, and it's no fun because it's written in the most unbearable legalese, if you read it, you, I think, would be appalled at its claims, because it involves a class action suit. If Judge Chin in the Southern District of New York upholds it, it means that Google and only Google would be protected against litigation by anyone who would be determined to own the copyright of a so-called orphan book. Is this coming out sounding too complicated? You know that orphan books are books that are covered by copyright, but no one has yet identified the copyright owners. So if I were to digitize such a book, and then a copyright owner would come forward and sue me, the damages begin at $100,000 per title. So if Google is protected against that kind of a suit, because that's what it claims in the settlement, then only Google would be able to digitize the orphan books and competition would be excluded. This is such an egregious violation of, I would say, the Sherman Antitrust Acts that the Department of Justice filed two objections to the Google book search, saying just that. So we're waiting and waiting for Judge Chin to make up his mind. It's been a long time, actually since April, and so every day I get up thinking, has he going to lay down his decision now? The fact that he's waiting such a long time might indicate that he's looking for some kind of middle road or compromise that could be worked out.
I would just add one thing. I mean, his problem is he has to make a binary decision. He has to either accept the settlement or not. And as Bob says, the settlement is about 300 pages of legal jargon, and I didn't make it all the way through. But I would say, actually, there are some very innovative things in the arrangement that Google, the authors, and the publishers came up with. I'll give you one example, which is people who currently own copyrights, books going back to the 1920s, would not lose them and, in fact, would be able to make a market in books which have gone out of print. So suppose I published a novel in 1940. It's out of print. Maybe 500 people in the world would like to read it. I can sell it as a digital copy and set the terms of the sale and so forth and so on. So, or even with Orphan Works, they have said, well, we'll set up a trustee who will manage the rights of Orphan Works. We'll put the money into an escrow account. People come forward. In a certain way, it frees up. People will be exempt from the liability and so forth, so suddenly you get to use things which are hard to use otherwise. So there are wonderful innovations in this settlement. The problem is it is private litigants in a class action suit, and so it's quite puzzling. One wants to be in favor of the innovations they've come up with. At the same time, the framework within which they're going to be settled is distasteful to many of us.
Maybe I should just add a quick word. For me, as the director of the Harvard University Library, the settlement could put libraries in a very difficult position because all of these digitized books will make up a vast data bank, and libraries will be asked to subscribe to the data bank through there will be subscriptions. We in the libraries provided the books free of charge to Google to digitize in the first place, and now we're being asked to buy them back in digital form along with the books of our sister libraries for a price that remains to be determined. Now, who will determine the price? Well, according to the settlement, an entity called the Book Rights Registry, but basically it represents the interests of the authors and the publishers who will want to jack up the price in order to make more money. So the settlement could be looked at as a way to divide a cake. Google gets 37% of the income, the authors and publishers get 63%, and the public gets nothing. It's excluded from this benefit, which I think belongs to the public.
I'm Eric Saltzman, and I worked a little bit with Lewis on the Google book search case, and I'd like to ask Lewis to ask the audience a question. The question is, for younger people for whom Google is what they've grown up with, and it's really hard to imagine a world or doing research or looking to find anything without Google or something like it, I'd like to know how much of these objections, which I feel also are the same worries, just seem almost beyond the point when you imagine the convenience that Google could deliver, the books that they could help us find that we can't find now, the passages in those books, and whether our objections just seem stuck in the mud.
Yeah, this is a good question. So the question is, as young people, as digital natives using Google, does it seem like, well, they do a wonderful job and therefore, and it's so useful every day.
And nobody else is doing it, let's get on.
Therefore, why should, you'd be sorry to see the judge smack them down and lose access to the Google book search. Anybody who uses Google want to offer? Yes?
We need a digital native.
I'm Christian Perry. I'm a fellow with Creative Commons. And I think it would be helpful to draw a distinction between Google having access to book knowledge and being able to share that information under, say, terms of fair use, compared to them having what amounts to a monopolistic right over the ownership and dissemination of this vast catalog of earlier books. In the same way that they have caches of web pages without retaining the copyrights to those, it would seem more reasonable, I think, and more equitable for them to have a similar relationship with this category of web books.
So let me expand on that a bit, because you mentioned fair use. So fair use is a part of the copyright statute that allows us to use other people's material without asking permission, without paying fees, in scholarly articles, in criticism, in education. There's a whole list. It's a complicated statute, but nonetheless it does exist, and it's a way of sort of squaring the conflict potentially between the First Amendment and copyright. There are many situations in which people cannot block you from using work because you have a fair use right. The Google case, for example, what they began by doing was actually going to publishers and working out partnerships, saying, we would put up parts of your book on the web and that might help you sell books. Would you like us to do this? And some publishers said no, some publishers said yes, 20%, some publishers said snippets, which is, you know, you get a line or two so you could do a word search. And then when they began the larger digitization project, they did not put up copyrighted books. What they were offering was keyword search and snippets. So a book of mine from 1983 would have been digitized, and you could search words in it, but you could not, essentially you could index it and so forth. And this was what the publishers and the authors took them to court about, saying even that is a violation of our copyright. I wish they had gone to court and defended themselves and said, we have a fair use right. We are doing something innovative, which does not destroy the market value of these books. In fact, it may even increase it. And let's have this fight and go up to the courts and see if offering a keyword search of in-print books is a fair use or a violation of copyright. Instead, they've come up with a settlement, but fair use would have been another way to pursue this. And if the judge denies the settlement, maybe they will go back to a fair use claim.
Chip Strang. I guess the comment first is perhaps Google's intent was a settlement, which is benefits them financially, rather than to fight the case and give the information away for free. That's just the comment. The sensitive question, and I hope it's not too sensitive, is why did these universities allow their material to fall into the hands of this organization without some protection as to future use?
Well, Google began with four libraries, of which Harvard was the first, and asked if they could digitize everything in the library. There was a pilot project. This was before I was here. And there was a great deal of enthusiasm for this as something that was going to create a magnificent digital library for the people. And this is when Google was in its fair use phase. So if you talk with people at Google, they say, we believe in fair use. Our hand was forced by these publishers and authors who were trying to protect their copyrights. And that may well be true. However, as things evolved, it seems to me that the nature of Google Book Search became more and more, frankly, a commercial speculation. It developed into an attempt to create a gigantic library to which access would be sold. And then there are other aspects of it which involve actually selling books through a so-called consumer license. So why did the libraries do this in the first place? I think that the libraries were naive, that they thought this will increase access to knowledge. We don't have the money to digitize these books. Google does, and they've got the technology. It's a great opportunity. And it was only when things evolved in such a direction that it became clear this was going to turn into a commercial speculation that the libraries began to dig their heels in. But Harvard is the only library that, we have not officially come out for or against the settlement. But we refuse to let Google digitize books covered by copyright. That was not true of the University of Michigan, of Stanford, and of California, which were the other first participating libraries. And since then, Google's dealt with about 30 libraries, and they have digitized books covered by copyright in vast quantities, probably a total of 12 million books or more covered by copyright. So I think was it a mistake to allow Google to get its foot in the door in the first place? Had I been making the decision then with Larry Summers, who was always very pro-Google, I think I would have agreed with him, actually, because it looked like a great opportunity, and public domain books should be made available digitally for free, and Google has done that. There are about 2 million books in the public domain which you can consult free. That I see that as a good, as a real positive development.
In this line, actually, Bob, I had a question for you, which is, I wonder how much of this could have been done with more transparency. So my understanding is that many people involved in the digitization projects at the various universities were signed to non-disclosure agreements, and people who advised them were signed to non-disclosure agreements. So it's been a puzzle to me how the decision was made, who exactly made it. And again, if you think about what is the policy end, one wonders why there wasn't more community debate about ends and means. Now, again, this happened before you came on board here, but do you have any reflections on the transparency or lack thereof?
Well, the first day I arrived in my job at Harvard, I met with the university council, and he said, "You are about to take a non-disclosure oath." Well, I'd never in my life had anything to do with lawyers except to make a will, and the idea of a non-disclosure oath I found quite terrifying, but then the explanation was that Google and the plaintiffs were developing something called the settlement that was going to determine policy about the digitization of books, but they required total secrecy. And all email, all memos, everything that had anything to do with Google was subject to subpoena, so that it's rather daunting, this notion of facing such a powerful company with so much legal baggage behind it. But Google deals in secrecy. I mean, that's the way they do business. Maybe it's the way most businesses do business. But they develop separate contracts with each of these first libraries and now with all of the other libraries. And those libraries can't tell me what's in the contract, nor can I tell them what's in the original contract developed between Google and Harvard. It's a world of deep secrecy, which makes it very difficult for the libraries to get together in order to create some kind of a common
fund. So in a way, you're describing an ecosystem in which knowledge is being treated really as an industrial product available for exploitation, and the larger policy questions are subordinated to that, which again is partly the reason that some of us feel distaste for this. The other piece of the non-disclosure is when the litigants in this lawsuit decided to try to settle, they had their negotiations in private. So the authors, the publishers, and Google sat down for 2.5 years and worked out this settlement agreement. There's no reason under the law that you have to do that privately. You could have invited other people in or at least told people what you were doing. And so one of the objections, as an author, you either are in the suit if you do nothing else or you have to opt out. And so some people, such as a woman named Pam Samuelson at UC Berkeley, has stepped forward for academic authors and said, you know, if we had been invited to the table during the negotiations of this settlement, it would be a different settlement because our concerns as academic authors are quite different from the concerns of trade book authors. And we are not at the table, and so we object to the settlement. But again, the secrecy part of this is, you know, it's part of industrial procedure. It's not part of what we would think of as an academic atmosphere. Regarding the commons, I think they would, regarding the commons. I mean, I think that was really their gut assumption, was that knowledge was a great inheritance and did belong to the commons. And in fact, I mean, digital copying and the internet make it even more obvious that is so, because it's now so, you know, we're back almost to the fluidity of an oral tradition in which things move rapidly and swiftly. It is a puzzle to think, if you were inventing copyright today, how would you set it up? And that would be a nice thought experiment. But I don't think, you know, even more so, I think they would have thought that somehow you had to preserve the commons of knowledge even as you tried to engender incentives and so forth by giving short-term property rights. Eric, did you want
to? Just further to that comment, your book points out that at that time we were an upstart country, an importer of knowledge, a pirate of knowledge, if you want to, using the term as loosely as possible, and also, which we certainly aren't now, and we're insisting around the world that intellectual property laws be strictly observed. It's one of our complaints with China and India and all along. And the other thing that we are now, we have had of an imperial nation, and we were just the opposite in the time of the revolution. We were trying to break away from it.
So this has always been the case. Eric is pointing out that we had a different attitude toward piracy at the beginning of this country.
So the question comes, how would they have...
And in general, nations which are net importers of ideas tend to be in favor of very low barriers, and nations which are net exporters tend to be in favor of having strict laws to get our fees from what we sell. And the cusp in the United States happens around 1900, but before that, for 125 years, we were a pirate nation. And I quote the original copyright law in my book, which has in it what I call a piracy clause, which basically says all these laws apply to nobody unless they are American citizens who publish in this country. So basically it says overtly we can take anything printed anyplace else and exploit it without asking permission. So,
those were the conditions of the U.S. before the Berne Convention. But I think there's another dimension to the point you raise, Eric, and that is if you want to invoke the Enlightenment principles... most of the Enlightenment philosophers, certainly in France, but not only in France, got published illegally outside of France and had no copyright protection. They were interested in spreading light Voltaire, there's a marvelous letter by Voltaire in which he says, I invite anyone basically to pirate my works. Just go ahead. And in fact, I found that Voltaire collaborated with pirates behind the back of his Genevan publisher. So he would get proofs of his works and then send them off to some competitor. So that the word would spread. And he would touch them up a little bit, then deny he'd done it, and so on. I mean, these are people who cared about what they called the Republic of Letters. Now, that notion to me is still valid. I mean, this may sound romantic, but I think that we live in a republic of letters, that it's a republic without police, without national or disciplinary boundaries or linguistic boundaries, and that the internet is the perfect vehicle for such a republic, because anyone who has access to the internet is automatically a citizen as a reader or a writer. The sort of wisdom of crowds and so on, I think they would have loved it.
Just to take this a little further on a completely current issue regarding WikiLeaks, one of the WikiLeaks is, of course, looking into what they can do. The Justice Department is looking into what they can do to Julian Assange if they ever get him over here. They said so, and they're looking to criminal... statutes and others, but one of the things they're certainly looking into is violation of copyright, because although the U.S. government doesn't maintain copyright to its works in the U.S., it does maintain copyright in its works outside the U.S. So in terms
interesting.
Of control of knowledge,
yeah.
Here's another example where copyright comes into play.
Yeah.
And information.
Yeah, but I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
Narratives that just emerged. One, the narrative that was told about Google's relating to different libraries and how it was almost a strategy of kind of divide and rule and having these kind of different strategies with different libraries there, and how in some ways this was it could be described as a failure of collective action. In that there wasn't a kind of the Republic of Letters, in a sense, the leaders of this Republic of Letters didn't sort of, in a sense, feel a sense of having to act collectively and have to raise this to a point of principle. And I thought I was struck by, in the previous narrative of Lewis's work, he was kind of talking about the Founding Fathers as kind of feeling sort of a sense of kind of having to sort of a sense of leadership and certainly a sense of first principles and having to kind of negotiate first principles amongst, you know, the great and the good of leaders. We might find that from a modern perspective, we worry about, you know, who's making the decisions for an awful lot of people, but at least there was a sense of a collective leadership decisions on principles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering, trying to link these two things together, whether there are some things that we can learn from the current to the current situation about how we can rediscover sort of this sort of sense of you know, collective action, and maybe also finding a way how a generation of leaders, for example, leaders of the university libraries, can connect with a leadership in a different generation, as in the younger generation who are in many ways now sort of shaping that field, the internet,
yeah.
And how they can still be still as citizens of the same republic and resume those kinds of leadership roles together. So I'm just kind of wondering how we're going to do that.
Mm. Well, I wish I had a good answer to the question. It's a very important question, of course. But let me attempt the beginning of an answer. I think that the problem has been legal constraints. I mean, you simply cannot talk with the head of the Michigan University Library, which is a great library, about the details of its contract with Google. And we face the same problem with the exorbitant increase in the cost of subscriptions to scholarly journals. We can't get together with other universities in order to cancel subscriptions, even though the subscriptions are outrageous. And our own faculty...
You can't because you would be a trust?
We would be a conspiracy and constraint of trade. Now, that, you know, no one's ever actually attempted it and taken that to court, but I can tell you, librarians are terrified about that seeming collusion. So we are in a world in which the legal barriers to collective action are considerable. However, one of the most promising innovations is HathiTrust. I don't know if you know HathiTrust. The word has to do with the Hindi word for elephant. There is a group of libraries that have come together to create a database of digitized books. These books cannot be communicated to readers. So it's very far from what one might hope for, but it exists. And it exists to preserve these books, including all of the books digitized in all of the libraries by Google. So HathiTrust could be the beginning of this kind of collective action, especially if they have a huge, I forget how many they have, but getting on 10 million books, if they could be empowered to make those books available under certain conditions, restraints, such as the restraints that are being worked out in the Netherlands, in Norway, to a certain extent in Japan. I mean, there are lots of things going on in other national libraries that we could emulate. So I think that we can create what I call a national digital library. We can seize the initiative if we can get enough backing, if we can convince people that it is in the public good, that it would be the creation of a kind of cultural commons of the sort that Lewis is talking about. And I think we're getting there. I mean, we had a meeting in October here at Harvard of leaders of foundations and computer scientists and libraries and so on. And that out of that meeting, a series of steps are being taken. But I think that it's now quite clear that we will have a major conference in Washington to launch this project with the backing of the Library of Congress, the National Archives, and the Smithsonian Institution, and I hope the Obama administration. So I think that things are moving, that we're not just lying down and getting run over by the commercial interests, but we're reacting.
Let me add one thing, which is this business of the enclosure of the commons. One other level of it is what I think of as conceptual enclosure. So, you know, if you're trying to think about subscription prices in libraries and you have to think about antitrust and collusion, or if you're thinking about digitizing a library and you're asked to take a non-disclosure oath, you are in the framework of property and the law. and you're outside of the framework of the circulation of knowledge and the advancement of learning and so forth. So one's constantly sort of drawn into these traps in which the way we're asked to talk about this predisposes the range of options we have in our discussion. So how
do we get around that, Lewis?
Well, I do believe in beating the bounds. I don't. Trying to organize a movement toward a national digital public library is a counter move to say, look, we missed a great opportunity. What's being done is being done entirely in the commercial industrial mode. Let's try to do it in a public works mode. Right there, you're changing the ground upon which the discussion is given. I must say I had a short fantasy in which you refused to take the non-disclosure oath and were led away in chains and became a civil disobedient. But I don't know if that's possible.
Well, since that fantasy is hard to top and anything else will be anticlimactic, we should probably conclude the formal part of this evening's proceedings here. But there are books to be signed, and there is wine to be drunk and food to be eaten, and given that with the blizzard you may not be able to make it to a grocery store for the next few days, we hope that you will stay here, eat, drink, talk further with Bob, Lewis, and one another. Thank you again, Lewis, and thank you, Bob, for this evening.